loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, sitting in for John Kiriakou, and joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the war in Syria continues to deepen in the wake of last week's U.S.-led missile attack. Saudi Arabia has offered to send ground troops to the country, and controversy continues over the investigation into the alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma. Next, former FBI agent Terry Albury pleaded guilty yesterday to providing secret documents to the press. In a statement, he said he knew it was against the law, but he felt strongly that the public needed to know about the racism inherent in FBI practices. Then, in a surprise move, Turkish President Erdogan has called an early general election scheduled for June 24th. With the government fostering a wave of nationalistic fervor across the country, opposition forces fear that these elections may further consolidate Erdogan's stranglehold on power. And then, the FBI raid targeting Trump lawyer Michael Cohen has put the principle of attorney-client privilege in the spotlight. What could the long-term legal implications be of the precedent set by the Mueller investigation? And finally, Donald Trump is acting as chief salesman for Boeing as he pushes Kuwait to agree to a $10 billion fighter jet purchase. How common is this practice, and what does it say about the U.S. economy and society? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to Syria. The war in Syria continues to deepen in the wake of last week's U.S.-led missile attacks. Saudi Arabia has offered to send ground troops to the country, and controversy continues over the investigation into the alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma. We're joined from London by Ambassador Peter Ford. Peter Ford is the former British ambassador to Syria. Ambassador Ford, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for joining. Ambassador Ford, there's a couple things going on. One is the OPCW investigators, that's the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, had arrived in Syria just after, I believe, the U.S. bombing, U.S.-British-French bombing attack on Friday night. But then there's this other sort of discussion going on that John Bolton and the other people in the Trump administration, but Bolton in particular, are trying to build an Arab military force in Syria, like the Arab NATO, and Saudi Arabia offering to intervene into Syria. Anyway, what's your take on all that?
Well, I think possibly the one explains the other. That Trump felt that he had to do something to look macho before he would have the credit in the bank to permit him to withdraw American troops from northern Syria. I think that is what has actually happened here. Now, it's welcome that he does want to withdraw the troops from northern Syria, it requires some courage on his part to go against the advice of the entire establishment, the security and media establishment. So well done to Mr. Trump for having that resolution. But I greatly fear that the plan to substitute Arab troops for American troops is likely to run into practical difficulties.
And what would those be?
Well, there's several. Much would depend on the modalities, how many. The idea is that there would just be a couple of thousand Arab Gulf troops, roughly the number of American troops, and it might not be all that difficult to muster a few battalions, but it would depend what their mission was. At the moment, the mission of those Americans is mainly just to act as a kind of tripwire, so that if the Syrian or Russian or Iranian forces come anywhere near where the U.S. troops are, then that will bring down the might of the U.S. Air Force on their heads, and that did happen a couple of months ago, and about 300 Russian contractors were reportedly killed. So maybe the idea is just to bring in a few hundred Arab troops who would provide the same tripwire, though I'm not sure that the justification would be very plausible for bringing in the U.S. Air Force just because Assad was sending troops to recover his territory from invading Arab forces. But anyway, maybe this is the idea. It's not going to work, though, because I very much doubt that the Gulf countries will chance their arm by sending forces into this theater of this cauldron of war. They don't have any experience of sending troops into combat areas. The Saudis and the Emiratis are quite good at bombing innocent civilians in Yemen, but it's another matter to send combat troops into the cauldron, which is Syria.
Ambassador Peter Ford is our guest. So, Ambassador Ford, these reports, and I'm looking at a CNN right now, President Donald Trump's newly minted National Security Advisor John Bolton and Secretary of State nominee Mike Pompeo are among those spearheading a push to build a coalition of Arab military forces that could replace U.S. troops in Syria and serve as a stabilizing force. And though, and specifically, the U.S. is pursuing contributions from Egypt, Bahrain, Jordan, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Your feeling is that this is never going to happen. Well, let's not, I don't want to be that categorical and put words in your mouth. Your idea is, or what you're telling us is, that this isn't really this isn't going to really be a significant event or development.
It would be significant, and I don't want to join the torrent of abuse that's being thrown at the idea, because I think anything that gets the U.S. troops the hell out of Syria can only be a good thing, and is Arab forces, some token Arab forces, serve as a fig leaf to hide Trump's embarrassment. Well, that's not entirely a bad thing, but I am saying that in practical terms, it's going to be difficult to mobilize these battalions. Financing them would be another and easier matter. But there are other practical and political difficulties, particularly how such troops would mesh with the existing local troops on the ground, the Kurdish Peshmerga, and whether these troops from the Gulf, who are literally related to some of the Arab tribes that also have militia alongside the Kurds. It's an unstable combination there that could lead to further instability in this area, which is called the Jazeera.
All right. So before we leave this topic, and I want to get to the issue of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons investigators arriving in Syria. But before we get there for the final part of this interview, I want to ask you about the prospects of Egypt or the Egyptian military sending forces into Syria. The CNN is also reporting that John Bolton, new national security advisor, called Egypt's acting intelligence chief Abbas Kamal to gauge whether the country would be willing to contribute to the effort, likely or unlikely, on the part of Egypt.
So I don't want to be too categorical, because the Egyptian forces, a handful of them, have been involved in other areas in some of the local reconciliations. They are not totally unwelcome to the Syrian government, because the Egyptian government and the Syrian government see more or less eye to eye on fighting Islamists, and basically Sisi supports Assad. So it's not such a crazy idea as it appears on the surface.
Okay. And we have about 2.5 minutes. What about the investigators from the OPCW? The media reports here in the United States is that the Assad government has denied access until now for those investigators to reach their site in Douma, and also that some of them, or at least one of them, was being shot at. Again, the implication certainly being that the Syrian government is obstructing the work of the OPCW investigators. Since you actually, unlike most of the people who are talking about this in the Western and certainly U.S. corporate-owned media, actually know what you're talking about, help us understand what's going on.
Well, fact number one, who asked for this infection? Was it America? No. Was it Britain? No. Was it France? No. Was it Russia? Yes. Was it Syria? Yes. The OPCW announced, and this is in their press statement, that the mission was requested by Russia and Syria. So you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to work out who has an interest in the mission going ahead, doing its work, and producing a fair outcome, producing the actual facts. Now, what we're seeing is a tissue of lies by the three Western powers to obscure the fact that they are uneasy. The prospect that the mission might find or not find the evidence that they need to back up their claims that it was a chemical weapon incident. And again, one doesn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to speculate who might have an interest in delaying the onset of the mission, who might have got somebody to fire a couple of shots so that the mission is delayed, so that the Western powers and the Syrian oppositionists can claim that the OPCW mission is devalued. It could, if one were Sherlock Holmes, one might think that it was either one of the Western powers, or perhaps more likely, it was somebody from the Army of Islam who had been laying low.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from London by Ambassador Peter Ford. Ambassador Ford was the British ambassador to Syria. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Former FBI agent Terry Albury pleaded guilty yesterday to providing secret documents to the press. In a statement, he said he knew it was against the law, but he felt strongly that the public needed to know about the racism inherent in FBI practices. We're joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. She is a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. Welcome back, Colleen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So to refresh our audience's memory, who is Terry Albury?
Okay, well, from media reports, it appears Terry Albury was the only a Black American in the Minnesota FBI office, which in my experience is not unusual that, they've tried for years and claim they're trying to hire more minorities. But in an office like Minnesota, which is frankly not that small an office, it's a bit surprising he was the only, Black special agent in the office. But in any event, he saw the manuals, the FBI's so-called secret rules for going around what is supposed to be the policies prohibiting infiltrating minority and religious communities under the old Attorney General guidelines after the Church Committee. That was strictly forbidden. Those AG guidelines got, dissipated and watered down and eventually thrown away. But still, it's very wrong for the FBI to be using criteria focusing on minorities and religious minorities and race minorities, etc. So he didn't know who he could take that complaint to. If the whole FBI is complicit with it, there's hardly a way internally that you can take it. There might have been some other avenues, Inspector General or the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. I'm not sure, but he obviously did. And he apparently made copies of some of these documents that were showed wrongful infiltration by the FBI and basically encouragement on the telling agents they should be doing this. And The Intercept then published a multi-series about these so-called secret rules, and then also made a Freedom of Information request seeking some of these documents. And when that happened, the FBI went to its computers and traced that Terry Albury had access to those same documents that The Intercept was making a Freedom of Information request for, and then pressured him. And now he has pled guilty today facing, frankly, a pretty stringent, severe sentence of up to 57 months, which from prior whistleblower cases seems really long, and especially for someone who is pleading guilty in comparison with other cases that have been publicized. I would say it sounds like it's almost double as long as what happened under the Obama administration.
Yeah. And again, you'd have to think that in addition to all other factors, the fact that he's the only black FBI special agent in the Minneapolis office and protesting about the policies of racial profiling or religious profiling, Colleen, in particular, the targeting of a black immigrant population in Minneapolis and in Minnesota, the Somali American population, for instance, that's who the FBI was targeting in this instance, no?
Well, in Minnesota, yes, because Minneapolis has the highest population of Somalis, at least one of the highest in the country. And they were able to make cases against some young Somali men who were, cajoled and enticed to go fight in Syria. And they had quite a lot of success in convicting these young men. So, yes, I'm sure that their policies were loosened and softened. Again, this was done in a myriad of ways, one of which was those attorney general guidelines were just basically thrown out. And so the FBI will say, well, now we can do this legally. And again, the real problem here is, if you look at it from the standpoint of a whistleblower, where do they go when they want to, even ask that, this isn't right. We shouldn't be targeting, an African-American community or a Muslim community. And look, I've got documents showing that we were told we were supposed to do this. Now, who does a person take that to? That's the thing. If it's wrong, it shouldn't have even been classified in the first place. That's the thing. You're not supposed to be able to classify to cover up illegal actions. And I think the thing now is these freedom of information requests, there's no reason to withhold information if it's not secret. And then the question is, well, then there wasn't secret to begin with, then what was violated here? It's really a sad situation for somebody in this situation of spotting something that's wrong and then not knowing who to take it to, who can even evaluate this fairly. Certainly not the FBI. The FBI is biased on this level and will never be. And by the way, this case seems to fall in a long series of cases where improper, wrongful action is covered up. One of the most egregious being the FBI's handling of informants, which for decades was allowing them to handle top echelon criminal crime bosses who were themselves murdering other people. Now, that's incredible. And if you know about those types of things, and that's absolutely been documented and shown, et cetera, when a whole agency goes so far off base as to be engaging in these really, truly illegal and wrongful actions, how can you ever get that remedied? You can't get it remedied internally. So there's got to be some external watchdog or something like the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Group that was supposed to, they were supposed to serve as a check on these things. Unfortunately, they have not proven effective.
That's the voice of Colleen Rowley. Colleen is talking to us from Minnesota. She's a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. Colleen, you're right. I mean, the issue really here, I feel so bad for this individual, Terry J. Albury, 39 years old. He appeared in federal court, I guess yesterday, in St. Paul, on one count of unauthorized disclosure of national defense information and one count of unauthorized retention of national defense information. I guess that means he had the documents at home. He was complaining about racism and the secret rules that would be used to interrogate minority communities. And now he's going to go to prison. The judge, a U.S. District Judge Wilhelmina Wright, will make the ultimate determination. But for as long as 57 months, 4.5 years for trying to remedy what he considered to be racism, he said in court, I knew it might be wrong, but this was an act of conscience. His lawyer says, The situation became even more acute for him, Terry, when, having previously served a tour for the FBI in Iraq, he was assigned to the counterterrorism squad and was required to firsthand to implement FBI investigation directives that profiled and intimidated minority communities in Minnesota and other locations in which Terry served. So Colleen Raleigh, I mean, you think of all the people who don't go to prison, all the people who have committed so many crimes, all the people who pretended that torture was legal, who enacted torture regimes, people who sent our, you know, armed forces off to battle to kill and be killed in wars that were clearly illegal. Everybody else is running around writing books, making lots of money. But Terry Albury, the one African-American of special agent in Minneapolis, he's going to prison.
Yeah, it's just another sad, really sad commentary on our situation right now. And perception management, of course, and getting people to go along with those official acts that you just listed, trying to get the American public to okay these military interventions and use of abusive interrogation tactics and all of these things requires their ability to control information. And so classifying information that really should not even be classified in the first place. And I think I said this the first time you talked to me about it, those attorney general guidelines and policy should be free and open. They shouldn't even be secret. The American public needs to know. So it's wrong even to have this level of secrecy on things. And the reason for that is they are trying to control the narrative, and they don't want interference from anybody in the public. And that just shows us what we need to do is people need to insist on much more transparency in government. They need to insist on a body that would be effective in listening to people who think they spot something wrong or illegal and have an ability then to have it weighed and looked at and saying, you're right. Now, an IG is supposed to do this. Look at the FBI and say, hey, FBI, you better fix this. You're doing this wrong. And that's what right now does not exist. Unfortunately, he's being made an example of in order to enforce this really counterproductive and extremely excessive and counterproductive secrecy that's hurting. Actually, it's even hurting the United States' efforts to reduce terrorism.
All right. You know, Walter, Colleen is completely right. Instead of declaring a war against whistleblowers who are blowing the whistle on illegal tactics used by the government, instead of declaring war on them, the issue is how to fix it. And I think she's right. Unless the American people stand up, left to their own devices, FBI, the government, it's not going to do it.
Yeah, we're out of time. We've been joined from Minnesota by Colleen Raleigh. She's a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In a surprise move, Turkish President Erdogan has called an early general election scheduled for June 24th. With the government fostering a wave of nationalistic fervor across the country, opposition forces fear that these elections may further consolidate Erdogan's stranglehold on power. We are joined from Istanbul by Jada Karan. She is a columnist at Cumhuriyet Daily.
Hello.
So, Jada, this shocked a lot of people. The election now going to be held, in just a little bit over 2 months. Why do you think President Erdogan made this decision?
Kind of a little bit a surprise for us, because although everybody is expecting an early election, a decision about early elections, this was a little bit different. This is a snap elections. I mean, we will only have 2 months left, and when you look at the opposition side, the main opposition party, they do not have a candidate yet. And today we've learned that they will decide on their candidate in 2 weeks' time. So we're expecting a kind of early elections, but maybe on August or on November. But Erdogan today shocked most of the people by deciding this snap elections. Before that, he had angrily denounced mountain speculation about the snap elections or early elections, whatever, despite deepening financial troubles and growing unease of his grip on power. He said he was saying that the elections would be held as planned. So this is a little bit a surprise for all of us. Everybody is discussing this, and this is a little bit odd because, you know, during 15-year time, always they tried to hold elections always on time. But of course, this is a sixth time in 4 years. We should remember that, and both presidential and parliamentary elections will be held on the same day. And he cited the developments in Syria, and he said they need to take some important decisions on the economy. And in fact, we should remember that he has all the power to make all these decisions. Turkey is supposed to have a multi-party system and an effectual parliament, but no, in fact, we used to have a parliament. Now we're supposed to have one, let's say. We have an emergency rule here, and today the government renewed it and extended the emergency rule for further 6 months, seventh time. This is the seventh time after failed coup in 2016. Of course, it's about Syria, it's about economy, because we have huge problems out here. And I think the chief of AKP and the president wanted to change this system rapidly to move to presidential system. Although last year they held a referendum, but, you know, we discussed that referendum hugely. And he also had just half of the half of the consent of Turkish population. So he wants to change the system rapidly, and probably he wants to deny his rivals time to organize this time. He has a lot of difficulties. You know, Turkish society had polarized deeply, rising inflation, unemployment, widening current account deficit, coupled with the meltdown of Turkish lira, has taken its toll. Although the economy, despite this good growth rates, they say 7.4%, but we have threatened with deflation. So if you ask the people, you see this studies recently carried out. Everybody's thinking about economy. It's the main problem for Turkish people.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you have, not so great economic conditions in Turkey. You know, there's a lot of unemployment among young people, for instance. You know, the economic growth rates isn't what it used to be. But you have a political condition now. And, you know, just picking up, Jada, on what you said about Syria, you know, the Turkish military won, you know, a pretty easy victory in Afrin, you know, a victory that, you know, many people speculate there is some sort of quid pro quo with Russia, which, you know, controls the airspace over Syria, but allowed Turkey to carry out this operation. You know, the YPG, the main Syrian Kurdish militia, instead of making, you know, a big stand in Afrin city, they withdrew from the canton. And, you know, Erdogan is looking pretty good, militarily speaking, in Syria. And so there's this momentary boost in his popularity that may be enough to paper over the existing poor economic conditions in Turkey. You know, you were referring to the referendum that was recently held to fundamentally alter the Turkish system of government, from one where the prime minister has the principal power, right? It's a parliamentary system, to a presidential system where the head of the executive branch, the president of the country, has very widespread powers. What are some of those key differences? What does Erdogan have the power to do? Or perhaps after this election, what might Erdogan have the power to do as the president that he does not right now?
Actually, they have all the power. I mean, it's a surprise to me. I mean, I can't understand the logic. But the most important thing is there is a growing consent on the population, and VC, a new star in Turkish politics. You know, we have our main opposition party, CHP, but they are not, they don't have influential leader, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. The problem is with Erdogan's main partner's rival, Meral Akşener, which she founded, she has a new party called Good Party. We don't know yet exactly that if they, if she could join this snap elections, but she is very, you know, energetic lady and Turkey.
You mean legally, right? You know, the one of the rationales for calling an election so early was that the Good Party may not legally be allowed to compete because of stipulations in Turkish electoral law. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. She may disqualify. Her party may disqualify. We don't know yet, but she insists that her party has fulfilled the legal criteria. And she says that she could run as an independent presidential candidate if she provides 100,000 signatures. She can do that, actually, a little bit. It's not difficult, let's say. But the main problem, because, she, by the way, she's a former interior minister and she broke away from Bahçeli's Nationalistic Action Party. So she's a big problem for both Bahçeli and Erdogan. Turkey always, Turkish population, let's say 60% right wing, 30% left wing, let's say central, I mean. But of course, AKP changed this long ago. Now, because of the problems created by Islamist AKP, Turkish right trying to get around this new rising star, let's say Meral Akşener. I think he president decide to have the snap elections before something happens in Syria, before something big happens in Syria, before something big happens in the economy's part, and before Akşener have more power to dictate something. That's what I think. But of course, we will see if she could join this snap elections. It's not, you know, I don't know at the moment.
Yeah, and we just have a little bit under a minute left. Abdullah Gül, the former president, he's rumored to be a potential challenger to Erdogan. Do you think that there's any truth to that?
Yeah, it may be. Actually, Gül does not have his own party. Let's remember that. And if he decides to join, most probably he can join with Saadet. By the way, we have a small party, small Islamist party called Saadet Party. And his leader is Temel Karamollaoğlu. He's recently, he has been making waves with his scathing salvos against AKP repression and the military campaign against Kurds in Afrin. And he's actually, he's another rising star. Let's say even the leftist guys on social media.
We're going to have to leave it right there. So potentially that's another vehicle for Abdullah Gül. Thank you so much for joining us. We've been joined from Istanbul by Jada Karan. She is a columnist at Cumhuriyet Daily. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Co-host John Kiriakou is traveling this week. Attorney-client privilege has been focused on in the news recently in light of the FBI investigating Donald Trump's lawyers. Well, that's putting it mildly. They raided Michael Cohen's hotel, his home, his office. This is an incredibly important democratic rights issue and perhaps the core of our democracy in the courts. That is the question of attorney-client privilege communications. We are joined from West Palm Beach, Florida, by Brad Schlesinger. He is an appellate attorney licensed to practice in the Supreme Court. Welcome back, Brad.
Thanks for having me.
There's divided opinion on this, actually. I'm looking at different legal scholars
and law professors, some of whom are weighing in and saying, look, the raid by the FBI on Michael Cohen's home, his hotel, his office, the seizure of communications, including perhaps privileged communications between Michael Cohen and Donald Trump and other clients, is a severe, gross violation. Others are saying, no, it's not, because it's legally permitted and it's to prevent future crimes from being committed. Anyway, help us understand what the issue is.
I think that both camps are making a decent point. I think one of the biggest things to understand about this whole raid on Mr. Cohen and the idea of a raid on an attorney or a law office in general is just how extraordinary such a thing is. So a lot of the former camp is in this was totally uncalled for. It's a gross violation of attorney-client privilege. You know, we can feel that way and we can disagree or maybe say that, you know, this raid shouldn't happen. But it sounds to me, you know, and obviously we don't, you know, even though the people who are commenting don't have all the information, but it sounds like law enforcement went through the proper channels. You know, they obtained a search warrant. A judge, a magistrate signed off on it. So it seems like from a cursory glance, what we know about is that law enforcement took the proper steps. Whether or not there are problems with that warrant or whether or not there are issues with the sort of investigation into Mr. Cohen and whether or not that search warrant, you know, is going to be challenged in court or they'll try to suppress, you know, the defense will try to suppress the stuff obtained in that search. Those are some of the unknowns that we just don't know because none of us are really privy to the court filings. If it comes to pass that Mr. Cohen is charged, you know, then we'll have a better idea of what the FBI was looking for, what they might have been able to obtain, and then we can better understand whether or not this sort of search was a fishing expedition or there might have been something real and substantive to back it up.
So, okay, so what would be the real and substantive issue? In other words, here you have Michael Cohen. He's been Donald Trump's lawyer. He's the president of the United States' personal lawyer. He's been his lawyer for a long time. He's been cooperating with the Mueller investigation and with the different Senate and House Committee and Senate intelligence investigations. It sort of feels like, and certainly I'm, you know, a fierce opponent of Donald Trump and his policies, his odious, racist, misogynist, Islamophobic, anti-immigrant policies. But it seems to me that this would have a precedent-setting impact, not only for future presidents, but for our sort of those of us who value and treasure the right to be able to speak to an attorney in a privileged and confidential way. If you don't know whether the FBI is going to raid your attorney's offices or homes and seize their computers, why would you ever think that you could actually talk in confidence with your attorney again? If you're a high-profile person, say, not just simply the president of the United States, but let's say you're a civil rights activist or a women's rights activist or Black Lives Matter activist. Doesn't this set a really dangerous precedent?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's troublesome to say the least. And you make an excellent point about, you know, how the purpose of the privilege in the first place is to foster the sort of open lines of communication between client or prospective client and attorney so that they feel comfortable, you know, sharing everything and everything with their lawyer so that they can get, you know, the best possible advice and representation, you know, that they can. And so the last thing that we want to do is sort of put a chill, you know, on that free flow of information between, you know, attorney and client. I mean, look, you know, I agree, politics can make for strange bedfellows at times, for sure. And I don't really want to be in the position of defending Donald Trump, Michael Cohen, or, you know, their ilk. But this is something that is seriously troubling, and it's definitely concerning. You know, the way that attorney-client privilege is supposed to work is that, you know, if you're a client, you have an attorney and communicate about legal matters and, you know, in the process of getting legal advice, you shouldn't have to worry about your communications being turned up in a search or having the government having raided your lawyer's office. So I think that when it comes to what is the potential justification or why this might have happened, it's hard for me to believe that there's anything other than substantial evidence that Michael Cohen's legal practice was probably mostly a sham or it was a sort of like an enigma where he wasn't really an attorney, but he was more of like this fixer that, you know, people talk about him and he talks about himself. And so, the standard to go into a lawyer's office and search and raid is, you know, what would require a search warrant, that there's a high probability or a likelihood that they have evidence that this individual has committed a crime or that the search will uncover evidence of a crime. I think that one of the things, you know, that you mentioned that's really concerning, though, is that this is a lawyer's office and the precedent that this might set. And one of the things that I think is a little bit unmentioned is how the judge, in fact, made a ruling that is probably favorable to the sort of Trump-Cohen position, because the lawyer or the Justice Department is essentially saying that they should be the ones to have these documents and to review them. However, the judge essentially said that both parties, the Cohen side and the government, should be able to have the documents so that Cohen's people, his attorneys, can see exactly what the Justice Department has, and that it's still up in the air about who's going to be the one to determine what documents are determined to be privileged or not. And so I feel like some things being lost in the fact that what actually took place in court is a little bit, on a positive note, for the privilege, insofar that Mr. Cohen's people basically get to review all the documents themselves. And it seems to me that more likely than not, the court will appoint an independent third party to review them rather than letting the Justice Department be the people to review them and determine what is and is not privileged.
Trump is making the argument that the FBI had it in for him, that they ordered an investigation over Russia collusion with the Trump campaign, even though there's been even still no hard evidence of collusion. That after he fired Comey as FBI director, Mueller was appointed by Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, that Mueller is a former colleague of Comey's, and that he's expanding the mission far, far, far beyond the issue of Russia collusion to find just about something to either indict Trump or his associates or his family as part of a political vendetta. And when you look at it and you hear Comey going around the country, you know, saying this person is not just physically unfit, it's not that he's physically unfit, he's morally unfit, you know, et cetera. He's obviously has strong, bitter feelings against Donald Trump, and probably, just guessing, those feelings didn't start after Trump became president. They might have existed during the election campaign because, well, how could they not, for in some ways? But that's what Trump is saying. Trump is saying the FBI and the deputy U.S. attorney in the Southern District, Robert Khuzami, who, by the way, was the individual who made sure that Lynn Stewart, the noted civil rights attorney, was sent to prison. She got 10 years in prison when she was representing the Sheik, who was accused of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. He sent her to prison because he said that she violated a gag order. Same guy now going after Cohen. That this is politics, and that as a consequence, the pristine, or not pristine, but the primary thing that all of us need when we're in court or going to court or facing our accusers is to be able to have legal counsel that we can speak to in confidence. That principle is taking a back seat to the faction fight going on sort of in the summits of the American political establishment, including between the FBI or sections of it and the president.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit hard to know because, like I said, we don't have as much information about the Cohen matter as maybe some people would like, or at least I would like, before being able to come, you know, to a hard and fast conclusion. But you're right. I mean, think about this. Think about you're a defendant in a criminal case in some state in this country, and, you know, you're in a position where you have a lawyer and your lawyer's trying to get some information about the case from you. Basically, if the president of the United States, if his personal attorney, if his offices are going to be raided, if his communications are going to be called into question that they might not be protected by attorney-client privilege, how does that make, you know, somebody who's just a lower rung individual in the criminal justice system? It's got to have a chilling effect, you know, on the ability of individuals or criminal defendants to talk, you know, with their clients, because the vast majority of people who are arrested or face criminal charges in this country are not high-status people. they're not the president of the United States, or they're not friends with other people in power. So the sort of the signal that gets sent when the Justice Department does this kind of stuff is that nobody's safe, and that if the communications of the president of the United States aren't even protected, you know, how are the communications between somebody charged with a drug crime and his lawyer going to be protected? It does create a serious chilling effect.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I really think that, for me at least, that's the primary takeaway, again, because we have to be aware that our rights are can always be eroded or chipped away at incrementally, and then new precedents set. And if it applies, as you said, to Donald Trump, well, why can't it apply to everybody? I mean, Donald Trump meaning the president. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined from West Palm Beach, Florida, by Brad Schlesinger. He is an appellate attorney licensed to practice in the Supreme Court. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm Walter Smolarik, filling in for John Kiriakou.
In the newest reflection of his America First policy, Donald Trump is pushing the Emir of Kuwait to purchase a $10 billion fighter jet. He's pushing this deal on behalf of a private company, that would be Boeing, the jet manufacturer, because the company has become impatient that this sale has stalled. We're joined from New Mexico by Greg Mello. He's the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. Greg Mello, welcome back.
Yes, nice to be back.
Greg, you know, this is a story. Reuters was covering it, arming the world inside Trump's Buy American drive to expand weapons exports. I just wonder if this is unusual for the head of state or for the American head of state to function as a cheerleader for a leading aerospace company or a leading arms company or defense contractor trying to promote international sales. Is this a real story? And if so, what's the history?
Well, it is a real story, and I'm not the best one to look at the history comprehensively, but I think that certainly administrations are constantly trying to increase arms sales, and it's a matter of degree. And I think that there have been waves. So, you know, there was a controversial, huge arms sale under the Carter administration to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia involving refueling tankers. And so it's not new. It may be new in degree or new recently.
Yeah, let's talk about the role of arms sales as part of U.S. foreign policy. How important is that?
Well, I think it's very important, and I think that's the benefit to Boeing is, of course, very real and very present, and it could come back in hidden ways as well. But these sales lock other countries into relationships and dependence with the suppliers of the weapons. So there's parts, and there's training, and there's you buy the weapon and you need to maintain it for a long time, decades. So it cements alliances and it prevents other countries from doing the same thing. So there's a geopolitical aspect of this that I think is really important.
Yeah, let's talk also about what's going on specifically in the Middle East, because this is for Kuwait. The U.S. is trying to get Kuwait to speed up the sale. It would seem to me that Kuwait isn't, you know, poised to really go to war against anybody, the royal family. And yet we also have a lot of talk about Trump trying to create an Arab NATO for intervention purposes in Syria. What do you make of all that?
That's a really good point. And Mohammed bin Salman just volunteered ground forces. You probably saw that in Syria. So, yes, U.S. arms exports to the Middle East are about half of the U.S. total exports, and it's an important mechanism by which the petrodollar is maintained. The Middle East is clearly of transcendent geopolitical importance to the U.S. It is, I think that maintaining as much control as possible there and cementing alliances and long-term relationships would be among the most important of any U.S. foreign policy objectives.
And, you know, in terms of domestic politics, these companies are very clever about how they arrange their supply chain, right, in terms of, you know, congressional districts and states with key senators. Talk a little bit about that process.
Well, usually in a big, big arms procurement, arms manufacturers are careful to spread the supply chain around to key congressional districts in order to make sure that there's enduring strong political support for a weapon system, and it would, especially if there's any kind of cost overrun, which is normal. And so, yes, there's a domestic political component of this, and it's really, I think that moving up, you know, 60,000 feet looking at this, this is part of the militarization of our politics and our society and our manufacturing base. And it's something that Seymour Melman started warning about in the 1950s, how we could hollow out our manufacturing infrastructure as it became more and more devoted to weapons. So in a way, what Trump is doing here is undercutting his Make America Great Again initiative by, you know, if all we can do is export weapons, that's not going to make America great again.
Greg Mello, the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, is our guest today. We're talking about the fact that the Trump administration, and Trump in particular, in person, is lobbying on behalf of Boeing, the major aerospace company and primary U.S. defense contractor, for arms sales to Kuwait and arms sales that have been stalled. I'm looking at a report that came out last month. It's from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. They said that, one, that the U.S. accounts for about 30% of all of the arms that are sold internationally in terms of arms exports. And I want to read a couple of sentences to you. The global transfer of major weapon systems between 2013 and 2017 rose by 10% compared with the five-year period before that, in a continuation of an upward trend that had begun two decades ago. The U.S., which is the world's biggest exporter, increased its sales between those two periods by 25%. It supplied arms to as many as 98 states worldwide. Those are governments, countries, accounting for more than a third of global exports. Russia, the world's second biggest exporter, saw a decrease of 7.1% in its overall volume of arms exports. U.S. exports were 58% higher than those of Russia. So we have Russia, we have the United States, France, Germany, China. You know, these are all of the countries are using arms sales as a business mechanism. And so you have behind militarism and the trend towards militarism and the trend towards an arms race, also, you know, financial incentives. This kind of lethal project for the world, arms sales, is actually incentivized as a form of good business. And perhaps in the case of the United States, this lobby seems to me to be so powerful that the Defense Department or the lobbyists around the Defense Department, that it constitutes, as Seymour Melman, the person you were mentioning earlier from Columbia, a power almost greater than the civilian branch of government.
Yes, exactly. I mean, military expenditures exceed the civilian discretionary budget of the United States. So financially, it's bigger. It's certainly less haphazard in terms of its political lobbying. So I think that, yes, it is more powerful. I think that one of the features of Trump's announcement that was, there's a code word in there, using the, quote, full resources of the United States government, end quote, behind arms transfers. That means spooks also. I think it means the gloves go off, you know, bribes and blackmail are part of this world on the importer side. So these are complex deals. They involve a lot of considerations. And I guess hearing you recite these terrible realities reminds me that this has a very personal aspect for the decision makers, many of whom go quickly into industry and cash in on their military experience in Europe as well as the U.S. So the NATO officials are often closely tied with the arms industries in their own countries and with ours. So the decision makers are personally making a lot of money and building their careers, as well as living their entire intellectual and moral lives within the militaristic universe.
Yeah, and that's something that never gets brought out. I mean, what we're taught in school is, you know, because our children, just as we were compelled to put our hands in our heart and say the Pledge of Allegiance to reinforce patriotism. There's the old cliche, of course, that patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels. But the other reality is that patriotism in this context, in the context of a calculated policy and system of militarism, patriotism becomes really pretextual, whereby the people of the country are asked to fork over their tax dollars to an industry that really is promoting war because war is good business. In other words, the so-called principles that surround nationalism or patriotism, in fact, really becomes just like a Madison Avenue advertising ploy.
It certainly does. And, you know, you have media like CNN, talking about the beauty of our weapons. We saw an arms bazaar in the form of the Syria strike, where it seemed like many kinds of weapons from many kind of platforms all got in on the act. And I think it's important to realize that these arms sales are killing people now. And Yemen is the really literally poster child for all of this, the worst humanitarian catastrophe since World War II. And these arms sales to Saudi Arabia are the cause of it.
We've been joined from New Mexico by Greg Mello. He's the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group.
We're completely out of time. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us at Loud Clear Radio on Twitter. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can also subscribe to it as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.